time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for August 17th, 2019. I have just a couple items before we get to our guests this week. Many of you know that I'm a board member of the East Coast Greenway, so it always gives me great pleasure to report good things that are going on with the organization when the north to south 3,000-mile route gets a boost. This week, the state of New Hampshire invested $5 million to purchase 9.6 miles of unused Seacoast Railroad corridor to develop into a crucial piece of the Greenway. With this major step forward, New Hampshire could move from last place to first place in terms of state completion of the East Coast Greenway. When it is completed, the New Hampshire Seacoast Greenway section will be a 17-mile off-road multi-use greenway connecting seven communities from Portsmouth to Seabrook. Really good news. Thanks, New Hampshire. And great news for the young Israel Cycling Academy team, as Dan Martin, the Irish two-time Tour de France stage winner, joins as its GC leader for the 2020 season. The Irish rider signed a two-year deal, the team announced on Friday. Martin, who's 32, won Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 2013, the same year he clinched his first Tour de France stage victory. He won again in France 5 years later, and Martin leaves UAE Team Emirates after two seasons. The Irishman said he wants to help his new team, established only 4 years ago, to reach the 2020 Tour de France. I hope they get there. We have two great guests this week. First up is Jason Mutchler. I discovered his story on the Zwift.com site, and after reading it, I wanted to talk with him. But I had to wait until he returned from Ragbri, and I think the wait was well worth it. Jason, who has retired from the Air Force after a 22-year career and a horrific incident that forced that retirement, is a member of the Zwift Dirt Team, a worldwide group of dads riding indoor trainers. His story will unfold in a moment. After we talk with Jason, we'll head to Colorado, which is not where our guest lives. He just happened to be in the States for a vacation. And lucky for me, and I think for you, he made some time to chat. Graham Watson is arguably the most famous cycling photographer of the modern age, and one to capture some of the most amazing cycling images over his 40-year career. Retiring at the end of the 2017 racing season, Graham chats with me about his career and what life on the road as a cycling photographer is like. So it's off to Minot, North Dakota, where Jason Mutchler tells us about what and how riding has changed his life. Good morning, Jason. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. You have a remarkable story, and I think my listeners are going to really want to hear it. So can we begin at the beginning? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in Iowa named Earlham, just outside of Des Moines.
Okay. One thing I saw that really intrigued me, because my husband and I took a bunch of dance lessons for a couple of years, is that you were a competitive dancer. Is that true?
I was. Yep. I danced competitively for 17 years.
What kind of dance?
Oh, man. Tap, jazz, ballet, acro gymnastics.
How cool is that?
It just so happened that our small town had a dance teacher there, and kind of got into it because I had too much energy, and my parents threw me into it when I was about four. And then I got picked up by a studio out of Des Moines that was competitive, a little bit more US-wide.
You know, I don't think people think that dance is a competitive kind of, I hate to use the word sport because I think of it more of as an art.
Yes. Yeah. There are competitions around the world that are, you know, you compete more of like how many people are on stage. Are there two people, three people, one person, or up to, well, one of our numbers had up to like 70 people on stage, and you compete against other people in the same kind of categories.
How cool. Did you do any kind of ballroom dancing where you had a partner?
I did a lot of dancing with a partner. It's called duets. But I didn't do any competitive ballroom.
So you came away from dancing at what point?
I finished my last competition a couple of weeks before I went to Special Forces training in the United States Air Force.
Okay. Yeah. From the sublime to the extreme.
Yeah. Actually, I joined the military and all that because of dance, really. It was a way to stay competitive and athletic because I saw the military as a competition, a way to compete against nations and each other.
Wow, how interesting. So what were you trained to do in the Air Force?
At first, I was in combat control, which is a special forces duty. But then after being injured a few times, I ended up being really trained to be a gunner in convoys.
And then came the fateful day. So tell us what happened on January 15th of 2008.
Pretty normal. We were just doing our convoys throughout the AOR of Iraq. And just so happened that this location where we usually would take enemy fire, my truck had a IED EFP, improvised explosive device, blow up on our truck. And when that happened, it jammed my door shut. And when I had to crawl out, through kind of a puddle of accelerant fuel that they use, kind of like a diesel jet fuel that was on fire, and it kind of lit me on fire. And then I was shot in the back a couple times while I was trying to put myself out, and we finished the firefight, and then I was medevaced into Baghdad.
Holy smokes, Jason.
it almost feels surreal. Honestly, the brain has a really great way of protecting itself. Sometimes, and I tell the story, it doesn't even feel like it really happened to me.
Really? I think mothers feel that way when they have kids. It's like the second one, it's like, I don't remember what happened in the first one, so I'm going to have another one.
Yeah, right after I was wounded, I guess they asked me if they could start calling my family. And I guess I told them no, because if they ever got a call from somebody that wasn't me, they would, you know, for 3 seconds think I was dead. So I made them get me a phone, and we had all these conversations where I told them, and they had to tell me years later that we spoke. I had no recollection, but I mean, I did walk away with a pretty bad brain injury. Yeah, I don't have a lot of memories of that. A lot of the things I have is from written documents of what happened.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jason Mutchler. He's a competitive cyclist. I'll tell you that, even though we're going to get to that in a moment. But this is just a harrowing story. So other than the TBI, which, of course, is horrible unto itself, what other kinds of injuries? I mean, you were burned, evidently. If you're running through fire.
I had full thickness burns to 30% of my lower extremities, which included losing some muscle. The bad parts were around the knees and things like that because of, as those scars heal, they shrink. Then you lose mobility, so you constantly have to tear those open. I had a dislocated hip when I was jumped out of the truck, and I ran on that. Had some pretty bad damage up to the hip. I had broken my hand, broke my jaw, blew an eardrum. Let me see, TBI, broke my ankle. Yeah.
Humpty Dumpty.
Random lacerations, things like that. But honestly, the first real issues was I went straight to a burn clinic because the burns were deep enough where they start being life-threatening because you can die from pain.
Interesting. And how long were you in the hospital and then probably transferred to rehab, I would take it?
Let me see. It took about 7 days just to get to the States, where I was stable enough to get me to the States, and where I went down to Brooke Army Medical Center down in San Antonio. I was there upwards of over a year. And then my rehabilitation started in which during that time I was retired from the Air Force. And that's kind of what I am continuing today, is my mental and physical rehabilitation with cycling.
Very interesting. It's a wonderful segue into what's going on now. So before we get there, what are some of the challenges you're still facing with those injuries?
My back is pretty sensitive. Physically, every piece that we kind of talked about, I have my days that are very bad to almost tolerable. But really, my mental struggles are probably the biggest takeaway that I have came out of this with. I have some pretty bad PTSD, which affects my coping mechanisms, which makes it very hard to be social. Been pretty secluded for the last 10 years. Makes it easy being a stay-at-home dad, because I don't really fit. I don't feel like I fit in today's society.
I'm not sure a lot of us do.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure I did before this.
You look around at today's society and you're going, wait a minute, what is this? So you are a stay-at-home dad. Your wife is still on active duty with the Air Force?
Yes.
And you live in one of the Dakotas?
Yep, we live in Minot, North Dakota for another 40 days.
Oh, and then what?
We got our chance to pick our next assignment, and we're heading out to Mountain Home just south of Boise, Idaho.
It's nice country out there. Pacific Northwest-ish. So
we're moving up to where we would like to retire, up in the Northwest.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I am, 37?
Make it up. I don't care.
It's 36 or 37, okay. One of those.
Clearly, we need to ask somebody else. Okay, not a problem.
Yeah, my wife keeps track of that.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, it's funny. My husband always says, how old am I this year? And I'm like, stop. You must know. No, I don't. So I guess one of the things I'm listening and hearing is that you are a competitive person, that has never left you.
Yeah, that was kind of ingrained in me in day one. When you grow up in a small town, a small rural town, you really have the opportunity to be in all athletics, anything you're in. And then if you have some ability, you end up being a captain and you get that chance to get that competitive bug. And then if you're successful at anything, you're always searching for that high.
Okay. So that brings us to Zwift, I guess.
How
did you discover Zwift? Did you already have an indoor bike?
No, not at all. I actually, when I left military, I was really into running, because that's what we did in the military. So I was doing a lot of 5K, 10Ks, half marathons, marathons, things of that nature. I got into a couple triathlons through that, but in no way, shape, or form was I even halfway decent on the bike. I just really relied on my run. And I was training to do a 20K in Des Moines. And I would see these things for Zwift just in YouTube commercials. Well, long and short of it is, I really have trouble running anymore, because one of the injuries was, I broke and had reconstructive surgery on my ankle, and my foot has been fractured multiple times. And this is back when I weighed quite a bit more from the military. And I'm just unable to run anymore without extreme pain. So I had a best friend that I grew up with in Iowa who is an extreme roadie. And so he did this 20K with me in Des Moines and brought me this old felt AR frame of his. He's like, this is for you. Just take it. Try to find out if this is something for you, because he thought I'd be pretty good at it. And so I had this little dumb trainer at home and got on Zwift. I think it was right during the Tour de France last year. So they were doing the Tour de Zwift and the Zwift Academy. And within like 3 weeks, I had bought a Wahoo kicker. Like I was in there immediately. Like I got it. I never even had a power meter. So yeah, within a few weeks, I had a kicker. I found my dirt team, my team on Zwift, dirt. And next thing you knew, I was just kind of competing with them.
So who are the Dirt team?
Dirt was it was and still is, it's Dads Inside Riding Trainers.
Oh, stay at home dads. How cool is that?
Well, yeah, it started with, I guess, just a few guys that just, they rode together at the same time and they were all dads. So we were all in early morning. And they're like, hey, if we made a team, we could maybe get 20 guys or so that would all want to ride at the same time. And then when I joined, I was like the 200th member to join it. And now I couldn't even tell you how many I know it's the largest team on Zwift that isn't a country.
Wow. That's so cool.
Because I guess Zwift just really, that's a demographic that Zwift goes to very well, is the stay at home dad. And we have lots of stay at home moms as well. We kind of call them the Mertz.
Mertz, like Ethel Mertz. Never mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Jason Mutchler. We're talking about the work he's doing indoors. And I'm going to call it work because clearly you spend a lot of time doing it. How does cycling help you in terms of not just your injuries, but your mental capabilities and problems?
I guess that's the biggest thing it does help me with, is my mental state. If I stay stagnant, the things that we talked about earlier become more real, and I think about them more often, and it gets to a point where anxiety takes over my life. But if I have something else to occupy my mind, then I can delve into that so deeply that I don't give myself time to think of something else. I mean, my whole day revolves around studying cycling, studying other people's abilities, what they're doing to get ahead, new events that are coming around. And then it delves into all kinds of other things that I'm into. But cycling is at the forefront, where I can be having a bad day and you kind of can't think about anything else when you're doing sweet spot intervals.
Right.
it's just pain, but it's pain that I'm enduring and I'm in control of. It's not pain that has been forced upon me.
So now you're actually riding outdoors also, because you just got back from Ragbribe, probably, you know, the biggest party on wheels. And you do have your friend from Iowa. We did Ragbribe way back in 1999. It was hotter than hell. So how was your experience this year with Ragbribe?
Oh, it was amazing. I worked with my coach to kind of use this as I treated it kind of like a stage race, where every day I would go as hard as I kind of could. I still ate some Mr. Pork Chop and had some beers and had some fun. But
good man.
But we really pushed hard. This was the first time I got to ride with my friend that gave me this AR, this felt bike. And so I got to come back, and he's watched me through time training for this. So we went into it pretty hard, and it was just an amazing experience to see so many people from so many different demographics and backgrounds and ability levels, just having so much fun. And then these little small towns, and, you know, I'm from Iowa, I'm from a small town, and we even went through my old hometown, and then to see 15,000 people that are just cyclists standing in the streets was pretty surreal.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I can remember that each day there was a woman who could not use her legs, and she was on a hand cycle, and we never saw her without a huge smile on her face. She was always happy and smiling and having fun. So I know exactly what you mean. That it's such an interesting experience, Ragbri. It's unlike, I think, anything else out there. It's very cool.
I don't think anybody can get on a bicycle and have a bad day. I mean, that's something we did as children, and it does. It brings you back to this feeling of freedom that you can't get anywhere else.
Well, that brings me to the next thing. What's your next big challenge? All right, you've done Ragbri, you're on the dirt team. What's next? What are you training for right now?
Right now, I am cross training for the winter. When we get up to Boise, there is a criterium circuit up in Boise that I would like to be competitive in next year. Additionally, I'm trying to get my coach to get me back into running. With the cycling, when I started cycling, I was upwards of 240 pounds. And at my lowest, I've been 162 with cycling. And it's made it where I've been able to start running again. And so I'm looking for a sub 20 minute 5K this winter, and then plus the Criterium racing, and then hopefully going to do Phil Gammon's cookie fondue.
Crazy Phil.
Next year. I think that would be really fun because I love how he is taking his retirement with cycling. I think he has some great causes that he brings awareness to.
He does. We had him on the show not too long ago again, and he's such an interesting guy. He's very funny. Very, very funny.
Oh, yeah. He's a character.
Yeah. So how can people learn more about your story, Jason? Are you keeping a blog? Or I found you because of the Zwift article that was published about you. But are you doing something beside that?
I don't really do much. I do have a YouTube channel that I race on.
Nice.
Like I race today at noon our time. So we have another dirt morning grind fondo race that I'll be back on. But otherwise, I don't really write about much of it. I kind of let that go to people who are better at that than I am. I've been asked about it a few times. I wouldn't know where to start.
Well, you certainly did very well here. There is a story about Jason. It is on the Zwift site, Zwift.com, The Power of Community, Jason Mutchler's story. And it's a fascinating story. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. I wish you lots of luck. I don't know about crit racing, though. You know, that's pretty dangerous stuff. But yeah, you seem to have it all together.
Well, yeah, we'll see. If it gets dangerous, then I'll change it out because I got to keep taking care of my family first.
That is correct. Well, thank you so much, Jason. Have a wonderful day, and I wish you so much luck going forward.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Jason Mutchler joined me from his home in Minot, North Dakota. As you heard, he and his family are off to Idaho in a little over a month to begin a new chapter of their lives. If you're interested in Jason's story, you can find it on the Zwift.com site in the news section from July 3rd. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with cycling photographer Graham Watson. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. This is The Outspoken Cyclist. I always wanted a chance to talk with Graham Watson from the moment I did my first podcast back in September of 2010. And this week, I got that opportunity. From the time he was 17 until his retirement at age 60, Graham Watson has lived and breathed bicycle racing, becoming the most well-known photographer of the sport. Now living in New Zealand and apparently enjoying every moment of his retirement, I did catch up with Graham in Colorado, of all places, where the Watsons were on vacation. Hi, Graham. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. What an honor it is to speak with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure with me, too. Thank you.
Well, I have just a little tiny story. So when I started this podcast, which was almost 9 years ago, it'll be 9 years next month, I said, you know, there's one person who I would love to talk to at some point, and it is you. And for some reason, it worked out that I got to talk to Luke last week, and now I get to talk to you this week. So I'm very, very excited. Thank you so much for being in the States, too. It just so happens.
It's okay. It's fun to be here.
Yeah. Are you having fun? Isn't Leadville going on today? Are you going up to see Leadville?
No. Okay. No, that's not nice. I stay clear of all things cycling and big events like that. No, we went near Leadville yesterday. We were in Aspen yesterday.
Nice.
And so it wasn't so far away, but no visit to Leadville.
I know there's a gazillion people up there now. So I don't think anyone who's been involved in our sport, in cycling over the past 40 years, does not know about your photography. You've done everything from stage finishes to those beautiful fields of sunflowers. Every year, our shop would get your calendars, which were just phenomenal, sold before we ever got them. So I'd like to begin at the beginning. Where did you grow up? How did you become interested in photography?
Okay, well, I was born and grew up in London, and I got into photography as soon as I left school in 1972. Someone offered me a job in photography, and I couldn't believe there was such a thing as a job in photography, because it seemed like a great, you know, opportunity to do something that wasn't working in a bank or in an office somewhere, or in a factory even. So I jumped at the chance, and I started learning from a couple of people in London who did all these social portraits of aristocracy and some foreign royalty. And that was my first 5 years. I was doing my 5 years, what we call apprenticeship, you call it internship. And I was learning everything about photography at a very basic level. But the problem was I lived about 12 miles from the centre of London, and I wasn't getting paid about probably literally about $12 a week at the time, at the age of about 17. So I bought a bicycle, and I pedalled into London every day. But eventually I got into cycling that way. I was already a photographer, and I got into cycling through riding into London and back every day to save money. And I joined a cycling club and got into racing, and, you know, I wanted to be the best in the world, but never was. And when that company closed down in 77, I just took a couple of years off and went to see the arts finish in Paris, and it just changed my whole outlook on life. And I had a camera with me, and I took some pictures and sold one or two, and I was on my way. And I became, from being a society portrait photographer, I became an enthusiastic cycling photographer back in 1978, 79.
That was a long time ago, huh?
Yeah, it's about 40 years.
It seems like a long time ago. So I spent a lot of time on your website looking at a lot of your entries. Your writing is as beautiful as your photography. And you had a comment about you caught a lucky shot of Eddie Merckx. What was that shot?
It was a picture of him, of Eddie Merckx on the Champs-Élysées on the last stage of his last ever Tour de France in 77. And he'd attacked off the front of the peloton and went straight past. I was behind the crowd barriers in those days, and he went past me and, you know, gave me a very easy shot to take. He was by himself. He was just pedaling along and not going so fast because of the uphill cobble stretch there. And so I got this little picture of Eddie Merckx, which I was very, very pleased with, and entered it into a competition in an English magazine, and won the prize for whatever it was. Whatever the prize was, I won it, and it kind of sent me on my way. I made money out of it. You've got to make, if you're going to be a professional photographer, you have to make money quite quickly, because that's the encouragement. And so I made money straight away, probably $40. But it gave me the motivation to do more.
Really, really. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Graham Watson. He is, if you do not know who he is, you need to go look on the computer and look at some of his photography, and you probably already know what that is. When you see it, you can put that with this voice. So what kind of equipment were you using back in 77 when you took that picture of Eddie?
I bought a thing called a Pentax Spotmatic, which is, in technical terms, called an SLR camera. It's like quite a baby one, but it was probably one or two levels well below what a professional would have used in those days. It was all I could afford, and I had a little 1.35mm lens with it, which is what I took that picture of Eddie Merckx with. So it was very basic equipment, one camera, one lens, and it did me a lot of good for at least a year or two before I started upgrading to more professional equipment.
Was it a black and white photograph or color?
It was black and white. You couldn't get color film in those days.
Yeah, I guess.
It was a black and white film, probably a Kodak film, and it was very grainy. It was wet and grey on the Champs-Élysées that day, and the film was very grainy, but it doesn't matter. It was just a moment, like a passing in time.
Wow. Did you do your own film developing in those days?
Not quite soon. When I'd worked for 5 years as a professional portrait photographer, I mean, yes, I did my own developing negatives and handprints. And this time I didn't trust myself, first of all, with these action shots, so I just popped them into a local chemist in London, and they processed them for me. But then after that, I started realizing I had to do it, and used to get my printing done at night time in my house, in a little room in my house. Used to go there and develop my films, and then dry the negatives, and then make print. It was a different industry, different technique back then, but it's it's all part of the learning stages of photography, is to learn everything from the ground upwards.
I agree. I think knowing that stuff really gives you a different perspective on the craft, and it is a craft. I believe that, you know, it's very artistic. So do you archive all of your negatives? Well, now it's digital, but then it was negatives. Do you have them all archived? Do you still own all of that stuff?
I still own all that stuff. I think some have got lost down the years. That particular image of Eddie Merckx has not been lost. It's been locked away somewhere. And I've kept most of my stuff. I mean, it's not that well classified, the old black and white negatives. It really is not. But what I've been doing for many years, and I'm still doing this in retirement, is scanning in old negatives, old black and white negatives, and what we say, digitalize them so that they actually are, you know, they won't get lost anymore. They'll go up to a server in the sky, and they'll sit there for whenever someone wants them. So the negatives are gradually becoming digital images, which I hope will last forever.
Yeah, right. That's pretty interesting. It never occurred to me to do that. I guess I should go look for some of my old negatives. So when did you start riding on the back of a motorbike and shooting photography, which is a whole different way of recording by photograph?
Yeah, I think I remember about 1981, I was on a motorbike in some of the classics in Belgium. And bit by bit, I think until 1983, I was doing all the classics on a motorbike. And then I went into the Vuelta a España in 1985 on a motorbike, and then the Giro and the Tour de France in 1987.
Who was driving for you then?
Whoever I could find, wherever I was. I mean, we used to find someone local in Belgium or in Holland or in Italy or Spain. And it's early days, very early days. We find a driver and work with him. If he's any good, you try and keep him, and you might find a driver who can travel for weeks on end out of his own country. And it takes a lot of years to actually find two or three good drivers in the whole of Europe. But once you've found them, you keep them. You just hang on to them.
So explain how it works if you're sitting on a motorbike and photographing cycling, which is not a slow thing. First of all, is the camera like automatic? Are you getting like multiple shots at once? Are you sitting backwards on the motorcycle? It sounds scary to me.
Yeah, people often say that, but it's not. It's no more dangerous than sitting in your armchair after you've had too many glasses of wine. you get used to it. So there's a rhythm and emotion to it all, and definitely don't face backwards. That's a no-no in Europe, at least. The police don't like it.
Okay.
That is dangerous, because if you're facing backwards, your back is the driver, so whenever he brakes, you slam into his back, which is dangerous for him. And if he accelerates, you effectively can fall off the back of the motorbike. So basically you sit on a motorbike, the same direction as the driver, and you take most of your pictures by twisting to your left and shooting over your left shoulder at the cyclist behind or beside you. And yeah, probably it was quite scary when I first did it, but when you're only 22 years old, you don't really think about it, and you're very flexible, so you can turn right the way around. And effectively you spend the next 25, 30 years doing that, just taking pictures over your, mainly over your left shoulder. The cameras, obviously, these days are fully automatic, and if you've paid that much money for a camera, you use all its technology, so you use it automatically and just tweak the controls. It's very good when you're on a motorbike, because you don't have to think too much about making changes to the camera system. It's done for you. But back in the day, in the late 70s, early 80s, was kind of fun, because you had to do everything manually. You had to focus, obviously. You had to calculate the light. You had to do all kinds of things, as well as compose the picture, and also to know which cycle to take pictures of and when to take them. And it was quite a good day out, because you had an awful lot going on, partly around photography, partly around, you know, keeping a good position on the motorbike, and many, many other things that are quite hard to explain. But it was a full day out.
So I guess a question that comes up for me is, sometimes you're taking pictures of riders, you've had some beautiful landscapes, and then you must come to a finish line. Do you don't stay on the bike all day, or do you?
Yeah, I do. You're on the motorbike for most of the day. If it's 6 hours or 7 hours or just 3 hours, you're there with every minute of the day. And probably for the finish shots, you leave the head of the race with about 10 kilometers to go, or 6 miles to go, or sometimes even less, sometimes 3 miles to go. And just hop off the motorbike, and you're waiting for the finish.
Wow. And that brings up another thing about the riders themselves. How did you learn? I mean, there are however many teams and however many riders per team, and it seems like you always knew who you were photographing. You had favorites. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But how did you learn all of these different riders and the teams, and then know who to shoot and what to shoot and that kind of thing?
I guess I just picked it up through, in those days, of course, there was no internet or anything. You read magazines, you saw the guys in magazines, both like French magazines or Dutch or Spanish magazines, Italian magazines, and you just got familiar with the main people. And then once you get into a race or several races in the space of a month, you realize you're photographing the same guys every day. So you just, like anything else, you just get to know who they are, what they're doing, what their role is. And also, obviously, you see when they do well or when they do badly, you know exactly who to pick up. I think in the early days, I was looking for British cyclists, obviously, for my first British client. And then I was looking for American cyclists for a magazine like Velo News. I was looking for Australian cyclists for a magazine in Australia. And it grew and grew like that. I became a photographer for a Spanish magazine in the mid-1980s and went to Spain to photograph the races for a Spanish magazine, which is kind of strange if you think about it, because they have their own photographers.
Right.
And over the period of, even a year, I would get to know, I'd get to know who to photograph. It became very obvious. And then as your list of clients grows, so does your vision, your need to learn to find other cyclists to photograph. It could be a Japanese cyclist or a Canadian cyclist. It's all according to who you're shooting for, really.
Did you end up learning other languages, or is English still your only language?
You have to at least get an understanding of French. Languages of the sport are still French and English. And everybody speaks English. Everybody speaks English. It's impossible to get around life generally without speaking English, especially in cycling. But I took the time to learn a bit of French just by being in France, and I could order a meal and have a little conversation in Spanish, but I wouldn't call myself anything more than bilingual, just English and French.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Graham Watson. We're talking about his career and his life as a professional cycling photographer, probably the most famous professional cycling photographer who has ever been. Let's talk a little bit about some of the riders you've met. And I do want to, we're going to touch on Paul Sherwin, because it seems like you had an amazing relationship with him, and he's such an interesting guy. What makes a rider stand out for you that you would maybe focus on him or her as opposed to other people in the team? What is it about a rider that makes them photogenic, if you want to use that word?
I think if I find most people that are successful at something in sport have a particular, there's an aura about them there, which often comes out physically in them. They literally shine sometimes. They stand out from the rest of the crowd because of their eyes or because of their expression or even just their body language, how they ride a bike. Obviously, I knew the best cyclists. I knew who to photograph. I knew they were the best, so you photographed them. But things that stand out are people like Sean Kelly and Alberto Contador, and many cyclists stand out. But it's usually fine. It's the eyes or the muscles on them, or just the way they ride their bikes, or just it's hard to put into words. But you feel it and you see it when you're taking pictures of them.
Yeah, you become the artist.
Yeah, it could also be. Much more physicality when, for example, they crash and they get up straight away and get back to the race, or when they're really fighting to stay ahead of the race in the wind, or the rain's coming down, or the snow's coming down on them, and they kind of, the best guys, the most photogenic guys, they just fight through all these conditions, and they're the ones that stand out like a beacon. You go straight to them and you can't stop taking pictures of them. They're so kind of they're attractive. And it does tend to be the best cyclists. It's not the lesser cyclists. It's the best ones that actually are better looking ones as well.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. So before we're going to take a break, but before we do, can you relate a story about one of your favorite cyclists that you sort of lived through over your career?
I've thought about this. It's quite hard to find one particular one. There's so many of them. I mean, most cyclists, you follow their careers from beginning to end. So like about some of them have a 10-year, 12-year professional career. And I found myself realizing, you know, at the same time I'd been photographing them for 10 or 12 years. So you kind of know them through their on-bike activities, but you don't actually get to know many of them at all, because they're in their zone. And to be honest, you don't go really beyond taking pictures of them. You say hello, and that's about it. You don't get into their private zone. You leave them in there. So I don't actually have any real anecdotes. There was one like with Cadell Evans, the Australian cyclist, who was leading the Tour of Italy, I think, in 2013, and the TV cameras were on him as he came back through the cars behind him. He comes across some water bottles and a can of Coke. And he knows me very well, and he came past me with the TV cameras on him, and he handed me his bottle of Coke because he knew I was probably very thirsty, which I was. So here on TV in Italy, there's the leader of the Tour of Italy in the Maglia Rosa, and there's Cadell Evans handing over his can of Coke to some fat photographer on the back of a motorbike. And it must have looked very funny on TV. And, of course, you never take food or drinks from a cyclist, but when he offers it to you, you take it. And so there was live TV filming Cadell Evans carrying his own bottles and a can of Coke back to the peloton, and suddenly he hands this big fat photographer on a motorbike a can of cool Coca-Cola. So things like that are very funny.
They are very funny. We are going to take a short break, and we'll be back to speak some more with Graham Watson. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
You're just joining me, you should rewind this, because we've been talking with Graham Watson. He is probably the most famous cycling photographer. He actually retired a couple of years ago, and we're going to talk about that too. But I wanted to ask you a little bit, and I know you've followed the sport as well as photographing it over all these years. And you've lived through a lot of the ups and downs in the sport. There's always been controversy. There's always been doping. What do you think has kept bike racing so thrilling for you over the years?
I've thought about this many, many times. Whenever a scandal comes up or a tragedy comes up or whatever, you do sort of sit down in the evening with your glass of wine and think, why am I doing this? But I think the very beginning of the whole story of my career is that I love cycling. I don't necessarily love photography. I love cycling. And very quickly you learn you're living a wonderful way of life, a lifestyle that very few people have. So you're not just following your favorite sport, or perhaps you're pursuing a cyclist at the same time. You're having a wonderful life. You're traveling the world. You're meeting foreign people. You're meeting friends. You're making friends. You're learning about cuisine and culture all over the world, which you never would otherwise. And so cycling is a very unique sport. And what I've found from day one, when there was some controversy in the Tour de France, I think in 1979, you think, well, damn it, you know, I love this sport. I'm not going to let these people put me off doing what I love. And the same philosophy still exists today. If I was working, I'd still have the same. Yeah, I love the sport. I love what I do. I love the traveling. I love my involvement in cycling, and I'm not going to throw it away just because someone's taking drugs or because there's been a really nasty crash and someone's died. You know, you get very selfish. You pursue your own dream, your own lifestyle. It was so precious to continue doing what I was doing. It overruled any other consideration.
What an interesting explanation. I really appreciate that. Well, because you've thought about it and you understand exactly why you're doing it. I think a lot of people do stuff and they sort of just walk through it with their heads in the clouds somewhere. So
I lost whatever you said then.
I said that I think a lot of people walk around with their heads in the clouds and they never think about these things. But clearly you have, and I can really appreciate that. So I want to ask you about a specific race, and I don't know which one it is, but do you have a race over these 40 some odd years that has been so interesting and spectacular that you could put it like as the most exciting race you ever watched? And photographed?
Yeah, it's an answer I've given many times over because it's the 1989 Tour de France. This year particularly was the anniversary of that, well, not the year, the 30th anniversary of that Tour de France. And everybody was saying how fantastic this year's Tour de France was in 2019, and it was fantastic. But it was nowhere near as exciting as the 1989 Tour de France. There are a few highlights of this year's tour which made people jump out of their chairs, and a Frenchman's going to win again, they said, and this and this and this. But when you look back at what happened in 1989, for those of us who are old enough to have been there, I mean, 1989 was fantastic from day one to the very last, literally the very last minute in Paris. It was incredible. There was a ding-dong battle between Greg LeMond and Fignon, and nobody knew who was going to win. You know, some days you'd write off Greg LeMond's chances. Fignon took the advantage, and then a day later, it was the opposite way around. Fignon cracked. Greg took back a few things along with it. And it went like this all the way to Paris and that famous time trial. And it's a Tour de France that's famous for the last day time trial when Greg won the Tour, I think, by 8 seconds or 9 seconds. But it was more than that. It was every day of the race. There was something going on I'll never forget it. No, there's been nothing since that Tour de France that's even lifted me nearly so much. So it's the same answer I gave probably in 1990 and many times over until today.
Interesting. So tell me why you decided to retire in 2017. And you're not that old.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I turned 60 in 2016. And I'd already said to myself and to my wife 5 years earlier, I will stop when I'm 60. I said I'll stop if I've got all my clients still with me. Or if I've got no clients left, I will stop when I'm 60. And so in 2017, in January, I was 2 months short of being 61. And so I stopped, you know, literally I had to do a race in Australia called the Tour Down Under because by then I was living in New Zealand, based out of New Zealand and going to Europe. And it was for whatever reasons, it's very much easier for me to stop in the Tour Down Under in January of 2017. And just you know, take a flight home into New Zealand, a 3-hour flight, and I was home and gone. And it was much easier doing it like that than it would have been stopping at the end of the 2016 season. It takes months and months to clear up your involvement in the sport and to sort of arrange, make sure your clients have coverage from other photographers. And it just took a lot, would have taken quite a few months to clear everything up. So I did it very secretly in the winter of 2016. And then I did 2017 Tour Down Under and just walked away at the end of the race and flew home to New Zealand, and that was the end of it.
You knew it was the end of it. I don't think a lot of other people knew it was the end of it.
No. Nobody knew at all. The whole point is I didn't want to say goodbye to anybody. I don't believe in goodbyes. And also, rather strangely, as a professional, it always takes about 3 months to get your money out of clients. At the end of a season, they don't pay up, you know, every week. They pay up when they want to pay you. So almost I had to get almost to the start of the 2017 season before I got all my bills paid by the clients. And that was another reason for stopping in January of 2017, was so that I could get paid from 2016.
Just like in any business. You know,
like any other business.
And that's an interesting point that you did have that perspective that not only were you an artist, a photographer, enjoying the sport and all that, this was your livelihood. This is how you made a living. You know, and a lot of people don't think about that.
Yeah, and also the way I worked, I've been around for so long and with all the same clients, and they lived off me, I lived off them, and we trusted each other. To the point where I would just send one invoice, one bill at the end of a season for the entire season's work, and they would pay it, you know, in one big payment. But sometimes it took months to get the money, obviously. So I didn't want to stop work in January of 2017 and have any bad feelings about a client who hadn't paid me. So that's the reason why I sort of clung on during that winter and just quietly made my plans to get out, but at the same time waiting for people to pay me one by one, and they all did pay me as well.
That's a good thing. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Graham Watson. We're going to actually move on to his retirement. I want to talk about your book, 40 Years of Cycling. It is I actually do not have a copy of it. I saw it online. It is beautiful. And in one of your web posts, You told how you chose the cover, and I thought that was a very interesting decision and process. Having somewhat of an art background, I understand what you went through, but would you describe how you chose that cover and how you came up with the three from which you chose the one?
I've been lucky enough to have lots of books published down the years, and most of them in the recent years have been scenery shots. You know, there's some beautiful scenery shots out there, and many of them made the covers of my books. But for some reason, I wanted to do an action shot, like a timeless action shot, so that the book was 40 years worth of photography, and this action shot was meant to be kind of not anonymous, but just an action shot that wouldn't show its age in 5 years' time. It just literally. So I ended up choosing a bunch sprint in a race called the Tour of Oman, and it was chosen for many reasons. One was the sprint. They were sprinting on the finish line itself. They were, you know, throwing their bikes at the line, and there's about 10 cyclists all in the same. They're parallel to each other. There's not one cyclist in front. Their elbows are out. Their shoulders are down. Their heads are up. And also, it was shot into the sun. At that time of year in February in Oman, the sun is very low at 3 p.m, and it made the whole background completely white. The road was white, washed out, and there were like silhouettes of the cyclists from the overhead sun. It just formed a nice image, and it came up against a very nice scenery shot of the Tour of Switzerland on the St. Gotthard Pass, which is cobbled and very twisty and usually has snow at the both sides. And I had to fight with my design about which picture ended up on the cover. And in the end, I chose the action shot over the scenery one. And I'm very, very happy with it. But I must admit, in hindsight now, I think I should have gone for the scenery shot. I'm not sure why, just that at the time it seemed right to do the action shot. But in hindsight, I wish I'd done the scenery shot.
Regrets. No, don't have any regrets. Nobody wants any regrets. No, don't do that. So the one thing we didn't talk about, and we're going to just kind of wrap up with what you're doing now and that. But let's talk a moment about Paul Sherwin. He passed last winter, and you seem to have had just an incredibly close relationship with him. Tell us a little bit about Paul Sherwin, something maybe we don't know. I know he was really a great guy.
There's an awful lot of knowing Paul. I mean, I knew Paul through what I call the four phases of his life, from being a Tour de France cyclist, because he was a Tour de France cyclist when I was just beginning. And I followed his life through from being a cyclist to him working for the Motorola cycling team in the 90s as their PR man. And then Paul Sherwin as the TV commentator that most people know him as, in conjunction with Phil Liggett. But also I know Paul as an African man of Africa, a man who loved Africa. And I was lucky enough to go and visit him there in Kenya when he was living in Kenya. And we all went on a safari together, him, myself, Phil Liggett, and our spouses. I made a wonderful time. So I saw those four clear sides of Paul's life, which is more than most people saw. And you know, as you know, if you've ever seen Paul on TV, he is that person. He's a entertaining, outgoing guy. You know, he was a dream to be with. And I think Paul and I were kind of similar in the sense that we were very independent. We ran our own lives. And we didn't expect anything from anybody. We just kind of got on with what we wanted to do. Paul wanted to be a Tour de France cyclist, and I wanted to be a Tour de France photographer. And we had that kind of unspoken similarity without making too much trouble on others. And all through the other phase of Paul's life, I noticed that we're not doing the same thing, but we had the same kind of focus and determination, very quiet determination to get things done. And by and large, we both did. And we just got on very well. We didn't see each other more than twice a year in recent years, but it didn't matter. It was one of those friendships that you just automatically picked up where you left off even 6 months before.
I was very fortunate to be able to talk with him a couple of years ago, and he was just delightful. And yes, he loved Africa. So you're living in New Zealand now. What are you doing with yourself now that you're not working as a photographer?
Well, the strange thing is, I'm busier in retirement than I was when I worked. It's I don't work at all. I mean, clients still buy my images, but they buy them online, so I have to kind of manage that a little bit. So in that sense, I work, but it's more of a pleasure than anything else. I get up in the morning, I do the internet, I if it's nice weather, I'll go out for a bike ride for 2 or 3 hours. Or if it's not so nice, I might go for a long walk with my wife. We live in a beautiful area of New Zealand, and we overlook the sea. We overlook the mountains behind the sea. And the weather changes every 5 minutes down there, so you're fully entertained every day. And I'm 3 years into retirement, and I'm just having a wonderful time.
What kind of bike are you riding?
At the moment, I've got a Trek and a Specialized, so I'm well covered. I've got a brand new Specialized Tarmac, but I've had a 20-year relationship with Trek, so I still have a ton of Trek bikes in the garage as well. No, the days fly by. I mean, when I was working on a bike race 7 days a week, the time went very, very quickly, but it goes even quicker now, and I can't understand why.
So do you still follow cycling? Did you watch any of the races this year?
Yeah, we have a great television system down in New Zealand, mainly through Sky TV. We get everything. We get absolutely everything. It gets the races in Europe. We get most of the American races, the Australian races. We get absolutely everything through one broadcast or another. I'm seeing much. I never used to see cycling on TV at all. For example, when I went down to New Zealand, when I stopped in 2017, for the first time in my life, I heard Paul Scherrer and Phil Liggett on TV. I've never, ever done that. I've never heard Paul and Phil together covering the Tour de France because I was in the Tour de France. And so now I'm getting highly entertained by all these broadcasters who produce the stuff and the commentators that actually work on the coverage of these races. And there's nothing I can't, there's not a race I can't see. It's all there. Probably I watch cycling too much, but it's still a pleasure to do it.
Yeah, see, we don't get it like that here in the States. I wish we did. Who's going to take your place in the world? Well, let me rephrase the question because that's not true. Nobody's going to take your place. Who's doing the kind of photography that you did for the last 3 years, or maybe somebody different each year?
I don't know, really. I mean, there's a lot of photographers out there, and they're all happily working away without me. There's not one particular person. I think it's a business that evolves over time. There's still some young photographers working their way in. Getty Images has quite a stranglehold on most of the work these days.
So yeah.
Their photographers of the world are piling image into class hands. There's not one person. The way this book went, which was global, meant that you couldn't be in two places at the same time. So it's gone away from one photographer going to one race to give his client one set of images. The client now needs pictures from several photographers on the same day in several countries. So it's got a little bit more commercialized, a little bit more institutionalized. It's I suspect it's a lot less enjoyable than when I was working, which is only 3 years ago. But it's just changing all the time. I couldn't tell you which photographer or agency or photographers have kind of taken over because it's changing all the time every day.
Have you retired all your cameras or do you still take pictures?
I've kept all my cameras. And where we live in New Zealand, we get these great sunsets. And that's the only time I've used them. We get a fantastic sunset in our winter time. But I bought myself a little Sony compact camera, which does everything I could possibly need these days. It's a gem of a camera, just sits in my hand, goes in my pocket. And there's one thing I didn't like about my job was walking around the streets with, a 20-pound pack of cameras on my back. And,
sure.
You know, I can live without all that camera equipment. You know, I definitely don't miss that aspect. So this little Sony camera does everything for me. And, I'll take a picture if it's really worthwhile taking, otherwise I won't bother. But no, definitely not shooting any action stuff or anything commercial at all.
Well, this has just been a delightful conversation, and I always ask my guests three questions at the end. So I'm going to ask you, what's your favorite food?
Risotto.
Ooh.
Italian.
That's very, very interesting. What music do you like to listen to?
All music, as long as it's not heavy stuff, heavy metal. I like classical music. I love rock and pop. If I was forced to ask which music, I would say just easygoing pop music.
Okay. That's good.
Something genteel and nice.
And do you and your wife have any pets?
No pets, no children. It's all about us. It's all about us.
You know what? What a great line to end this conversation with. It's all about us. Well, Graham Watson, it has just been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much. Have a very happy retirement. And thanks for being probably one of the highlights of our cycling world with your work.
Okay, it's a pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
If you're interested in learning more about Graham Watson's work, or you want to purchase any of his prints, or get a copy of his book, 40 Years of Bicycle Racing, you can log on to grahamwatson.com. So that's our show for this week. I want to thank Graham and Jason Mutchler for taking time to chat with me. Won't you please join our conversation or start a new one on our Facebook page? Leave us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or make a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. If you subscribe to our podcast, please leave a review on your app. Those ratings are how new folks find out about us. Thank you for listening. We will be back with a brand new show next week. And oh, don't forget, the Vuelta is about to start. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.